IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. My name is Malati Renate, and I head the policy school here at Takshashila. And today's topic, we're going to be talking about the human-animal conflict. And I have with me two very special guests from the Humane Society International, India, Vinod Krishnan, who is a manager of the Human-Wildlife Coexistence, and his work has focused on designing and implementing human-elephant conflict mitigation strategies. And I also have Shubhra Sote, who's a specialist, also an environmental lawyer and researcher who has been closely working with forest departments, public prosecutors, and the judiciary across India. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. And it's a very interesting topic because this has been in the news of late, right? And we know that in general, human-wildlife conflict is when, encounters happen between humans and wildlife that lead to negative results, right? And it's because they're vying for the same resources. This could result in a loss of property, livelihoods, and even life, right? So maybe to begin with, I'd like to know, Shubhra, maybe we could begin with you. You could identify the gaps in policies and looking at wildlife management policies in hindsight and reflect on how those can affect, communities around wildlife.
Yeah, sure. So looking at the principal act that governs wildlife in general is the Wildlife Protection Act. Mm-hmm. And the primary tool for conservation for the longest time has been declaring protected areas. And these declarations, for instance, Sundarbans was declared a tiger reserve initially and then a national park. So this, what essentially that does is it creates inviolate zones. Mm-hmm. So people are pushed out to a great extent. So right. This happened in Sundarbans also where the community aspect or the livelihood aspect of the people living there wasn't really taken into consideration. And, it got a lot of attention. It's a Ramsar site. It's a UNESCO World Heritage site. But the whole people aspect was kept out. And this has affected communities in a huge way because there are these inviolate zones. So fishermen can't venture into waters.
Okay.
And they can only fish in buffer areas. So, that has affected their livelihood. They often venture into these protected areas to fish. They get caught by the forest department and then they, face right. penalties, harassment. Again, this also makes them ineligible to get compensation. So there are tigers in Sundarbans and there's conflict with tigers. So if a person does, is affected by a tiger, they cannot apply for compensation if they were in a protected area. Because what were you doing there? It makes them ineligible instantly. So it is quite exclusionary in a lot of ways, the principal act itself. And then, a lot of policies that come based on the ideology of the principal act are then therefore very exclusionary.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what measures have been taken locally there along to this?
Locally, a lot of focus and emphasis is on tigers again as a charismatic species. So there's a lot of resources going into counting tigers and it is also a Project Tiger site.
Right.
So sadly, a lot of organizations definitely are doing something about it, but mostly the government focus or policy focus has been that. I could also give another example about this, exclusion is in Odisha. So in Odisha, Olive Ridley's nest along the coast. And which is why there is a fishing ban around that time. And generally across the country, there is a fishing ban during the repopulation season. Only for that reason, the fishing is not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is across the country. But Odisha in particular, because Olive Ridley's nest, again, there's a fishing ban, which is a 7-month ban. And the previous ban is during monsoon. So mm-hmm. again, this has affected livelihood. Although it has been great, it has done wonders for Olive Ridley conservation. Again, it has excluded communities and there's a loss of livelihood.
Okay. Well, so the lack of policies that currently, that means there's a lack of policies that talk about wild animal welfare, right?
Yeah.
Especially in conflict situations. So would you want to a bit more about that?
Sure. With the welfare, a lot of policies and a lot of SOPs, because there's a flood of SOPs to deal with the human-wildlife conflict. There are certain private organizations which have published guidelines to do that. Then there are also, it's also at state level where guidelines are released as to how to deal with a conflict situation.
Okay.
It's mostly preventive. And, you know, there would be specifications as to, how do you dart the animal? How do you, you know, what sort of tranquilizer you are supposed to use? But there's very little on what about the welfare of this animal.
Mm.
Another huge gap, in my opinion, is how ill-equipped our country is with the rehabilitation centers, rescue centers. There are far and few. And even if an animal is captured, often they don't know where to take the animal. So even though it has been extracted, there is nowhere to take the animal now and to give it proper, you know, veterinary care. So that is another...
I've found many instances where during this conflict, either the animal is injured badly or, you know, dies, right, in captivity, because it's also been attacked by people.
Yeah, so one recent example happened where an elephant was captured from the Hassan region, which is a high conflict, a human-elephant conflict in area in Karnataka, translocated the animal to Bandipur, and the elephant goes strays out of Bandipur because that's a natural instinct there.
They're probably
trying to home back.
Yes.
And this elephant ends up in a town in Kerala. Very docile animal. Several people have been seeing him in Assam. The only thing was he used to walk on roads during the day. It was no danger. He would just be very comfortable to walk amidst people or villages. And he was perceived as, you know, this problem animal. So that was the whole basis of translocating the elephant. Now he ends up in a town in Kerala. They see a radio collar around him and instantly recognize that this is Karnataka's elephant.
Okay.
Right. So, well, elephants don't have administrative boundaries. But here is a situation where an animal is seen as, oh, why is the Karnataka elephant here in Kerala? So there was a lot of protest in the town where he was seen. Then it was then ordered to recapture the animal and put him back into a forest. This is bordering Nagarhole National Park, which is Kerala and Karnataka border. But unfortunately, because of all this stress of recapturing, he was in a town all day. That is itself very stressful. And now you're trying to chemically immobilize the animal in an attempt to recapture. And he died during the capture operation. So how are we managing conflict? Are we being very reactive of saying, oh, this animal is problematic, so let's take the animal into captivity? There are many guidelines which say that capture should be the last option unless there is proven evidence of an animal causing any harm or injury to people over a period of time, visual evidence. That should be the last option. But unfortunately, we've come to a situation where there is this demand for removing animals and, you know, it's become very sort of tense in many areas. This is one of the many examples.
One of the many. And we see a lot more of it now in the news, at least here in Bangalore. We hear a lot of even leopard human conflicts happening on the outskirts. It's one thing that it's there and we need to kind of learn to coexist rather than think of it as a conflict in a negative way, but learn how to coexist. And so that means educating even the people, right, about how they have to handle it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, coexistence we should be mindful of using the word very carefully.
Mm.
It's often romanticized also.
True.
It's really not easy to coexist with potentially dangerous animals, but it is possible if we have the right measures in place. And that's a lot of agencies, communities working in tandem to ensure well-being of the animal and well-being of people. It is possible, but it needs a lot of work.
Yeah, no, I agree. Just anecdotal, I'm just sharing. Where my parents live in here in Bangalore, we have a troop of monkeys that visit the house in that region, that residential area, every day. And that's also because there are two or three mango trees in the area. Now it's the mangoes and the trees are laden with fruits. And so they come there every day. And then there are at least 10 or 15 of them. And there's also alpha male amongst them. And they, of course, they do dirty the place in the sense that literally plucking the mangoes, they're sitting on the compound walls and then, you know, helping themselves and also dirtying the place and by relieving themselves. But end of the day, they're not really causing any harm. They're just going about with their own business. And then even the people in that area are quite comfortable with them. I mean, the first reaction when we moved into that area, when my parents moved in, and we were like, oh my goodness, the monkey sitting near the gate. How do I get out, right? But then we had a maid who was very used to that locality, just opening the gate, walking in, and the monkey didn't do anything. Right? So I know there's that fear that comes with, and of course, it depends also on the type of animal. If you see an elephant or a tiger, the reaction is going to be quite different. But I think, yeah, like you mentioned, right, ensuring that people are aware of the do's and don'ts, what's the distance you maintain, right? And we see that in safaris and others, people want to get closer to an animal when you know that it's a dangerous animal. It's a wild animal, end of the day, right? You need to respect and give it that space. So yes, I think educating the society too is a very important factor.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So talking about the lack of policies, right, that govern reporting of conflict, especially in mass media, and the impact it has on the perception of wildlife, right? Would you like to talk a bit about that, Vinod?
I'm just going to pick up what you said about leopards as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, Bangalore has always had leopards in the outskirts, many parts of Bangalore. But why is it that it's only now that we see that, oh, there's a leopard, the forest department needs to do something about it? It's a shift in how people perceive an animal. And most of the time, our only access to information about any wildlife is through media.
Okay.
It's either print or visual media,
sure.
Right? So unfortunately, in many of these cases, just the mere sighting of a leopard is sensationalized to an extent where people start to fear it. It's also about how cities have expanded and slowly eating up into leopard habitats. Leopards are, unlike tigers, survive in completely, you know, different habitat types. They survive in smaller vegetation. They don't need large forests. Their diet is very, very diverse, from small mammals to everything. They opportunistically pick up dogs. So it's also that our cities are generating so much trash, poultry waste, or whatever. Stray dogs come to feed on garbage, and so it attracts leopards. So there's a whole bunch of other factors that determine where a leopard goes. And with so many people building houses and CCTV cameras everywhere, and people having mobile phones, just that people are seeing a leopard and able to record it. Whereas historically, people have seen leopards, they have just let it go and people go their way. But and then media picks it up and plays it in loop on news channels saying, oh my God, there's a leopard. And then you have resident welfare association saying, oh, this is such a safety concern. But the leopard is not out there to eat.
Right.
Like on people, it's just going about its. And that's when media plays a key role of how do we want to report on? What is the language we use? We often read news articles which say rogue elephant or killer tiger, right? So there's a perception that animals are here to deliberately, you know, cause harm to people. For an average reader, it sounds really scary. And the moment they see it close to their houses, they'll associate with these very strong adjectives. So that is where we need to really focus. So again, my reporting on conflict has to be very balanced. Can't be heavily biased towards people, or I mean, we also need to address a larger issue of why is the animal coming here. No one speaks about habitats. Why are elephants in an agricultural area or a coffee estate? Is because we're losing prime habitats to a lot of other purposes, non-forestry purposes. This is where media play a role in educating people about why, what is the situation on ground, as opposed to just sensationalizing. I was recently happened to read a Kannada article where the headline said elephant crossing the road in broad daylight. And this was on the highway going from Mysore to Coorg, where there is a stretch of a forest area that you encounter. And the elephant is crossing the road from one patch of the forest to another. But in bold letters, headline says elephant on the road in broad daylight. Well,
we share the land, right? I mean, I think that's the very basic thing that people forget.
So that's, I strongly feel that we of course, as people working in conservation spirits, we need to engage a lot more with media, which we are doing, of course, and trying. But it's also that media needs to be mindful of how they report and right. the language.
Their personal biases doesn't come in.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And before we kind of wrap up on the government related and the policies and other things, we'd like to move on to the bazaar and the Samaj as well. Currently, how cooperative has the government been in your experience? Has data been shared across, let's say, you know, between states so that they can help? Because like you mentioned, right, when the elephant crosses from Karnataka to Kerala, I mean, the elephant has, there's no boundaries, right, for it. It's a territory. It's just looking for, it's foraging. And so do you see that happening? Do you see that, how comfortable is it working with the government on these issues?
In terms of states sharing information about animal movement, because of the recent incidents, now there seems to be three states that have come together, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, and Kerala. They seem to be coming up with some measures of, you know, in case there are animals at the border areas to share, particularly elephants, if they have radio collars, to mutually share data. It's slowly happening now. It's a step in the right direction. There isn't much collaboration among states. In fact, leave states, if we look at two forest divisions within the state, there's very little information exchange happening of where animals are moving. While we can definitely leverage, you know, so much technology, because there are so many elephants that are radio collared, and we can use that information to have better, you know, tracking and management practices, it really hasn't been so active so far. There seems to be some conversations and hopefully some steps in sharing information among states, which currently, as we
said, is it a capacity issue, do you think, or is it more of...
We also need to look at how, as a department, you know, for forest department, for example, each state will have so many other things. I mean, they need to look at anti-poaching, you know, any illegal activities, protection of wildlife. So their hands are full. These things of, oh, I need to share.
It's the last thing on their mind.
Yeah, it's the last thing. And we have to agree that they are stretched in a lot of ways. We cannot blame all the time Forest Department for inaction because there are so many other things that are their primary risk.
And they're firefighting.
All the time. And they have to also deal with, you know, conflict and all the paperwork with respect to filing compensations and things like that. So unless there is a few people or manpower allocated particularly to follow this and track the animals' movement, we cannot blame them saying, why are they not doing? So there are so many other primary responsibilities that they have to cater to on a daily basis.
Right, right. And since you mentioned about covering losses, right, maybe Shubhra, would you want to just talk about the Pradhan Mantri scheme that is there for us?
Yeah, sure. So the Pradhan Mantri Bima Fasal Yojana does insure against any, you know, natural unavoidable risk. And historically, a lot of, you know, schemes have not taken into consideration any crop breeding by wildlife. But there has been addition of any sort of, it's worded as wild animal attack on crop is what it's worded as in this particular scheme in this Yojana, and it is covered, although there are many qualifiers. There's almost like, when you go through the vocabulary and what's in the scheme, the primary document, the text is very unintentional. It's almost like, oh, this is a very pilot thing. And again, the onus has been shifted to the Forest Department. Like Vinod just said, they're stretched so thin. We will meet a Forest Department officer. He has just come back from court and he's literally done firefighting a day before. Okay. And he has to deal with forest management, communities, etc. And now again, even this scheme, which was, we were hopeful, would maybe shift the onus towards the agricultural department, but it is mostly on the Forest Department to again, you know, provide ex gratia and provide compensation. And the qualifiers for, you know, claiming compensation under the scheme is, those qualifiers are much higher and, you know, manifold as compared to other sorts of losses. If there's a flood, any sort of inundation, anything else, the qualifiers are much, much more. And again, like I said, the state forest departments are supposed to take on the load of this and, you know, notify correct crops and notify animals raiding from whom would lead to a compensation. And then there are also other qualifiers which say that there should be a media coverage, you know, reporting of certain incidents of crop raiding. However, there are some small landholders who may not find coverage in media. It is the sort of occurrence which might not find place in media. And that is, I think, an unfortunate qualifier to a large extent.
Yeah. Thanks. So we'll take a short break now. And maybe after the break, we'll look at the bazaar and the sarkar. See you on the other side.
Public policy affects every aspect of your life, from the roads near your home and the lakes in your city, to education and health, to international trade and foreign policy. If you want to understand this interplay of politics, economics, polity and governance, Takshashila Institution's public policy courses are made just for you. The 12-week graduate certificate program gives you a window into the basics of public policy. You can choose to explore the areas of defense and foreign affairs, tech and policy, or advanced public policy. The course is completely online and is conducted on weekends, making it a perfect fit for working professionals. The applications for the May 2024 cohort are now open. Visit school.takshashila.org.in. For more information, visit www.school.takshashila.org.in or click the link in the show notes.
Hi and welcome back from the break. I have Vinod and Shubhra. In fact, Shubhra, I missed mentioning it, but she's an alum of Takshashila. She's done her GCPP program with us a couple of years ago. So it was so nice when, coincidentally, when I was just having a conversation with her and she said, hey, I've actually done the GCPP program. So it's nice having you here as well, Shubhra.
Thank you.
So we were speaking about the government and the policies that the government has currently. And the challenges also that they face is primarily from capacity limitations, basically, you know, and other challenges that they face locally because in the firefighting mode most of the time. Now we'll just take a look at the bazaar, which is the market and the industry, and how they can possibly spread awareness and the other areas in which they can come in. So to begin with, I would just like to ask Shubhra, the lack of uptake from private insurance providers, right? For crop and livestock insurance to cover the losses. I know we spoke about the Pradhan Mantri thing just before, but would you want to touch about any on that?
So the scale of damage that happens due to wild animals, crops, is quite widespread across the country.
Right.
It could be elephants, wild boars, nilgai in certain areas, so different species across different areas. But despite the scale and, you know, the economic burden of what communities go through, there has been, to be honest, zero sort of involvement from private insurance agencies. This is completely left to the forest department. And over the years, we have seen many state governments increase, ex gratia. It's not even compensation, it's ex gratia. So crop ex gratia, for example, in Karnataka, if a farmer loses a quintal of paddy, he or she used to get 1,300 rupees until last year, but it was doubled to 2,600 per quintal.
Okay.
Right. But it's also a process that a farmer has to go file an application, then wait for the money to be credited into his or her account. Of course, Karnataka and quite a few states have digitized this whole thing. In Karnataka, we have something called e-parihara, which is now speedens up the process, but it's a great step. But still, where the farmer is completely dependent on that compensation that he receives from a forest department. But it would be really good to have, you know, private sector involvement, even as someone who can facilitate the speedening up of this whole process. Because so many times it so happens that the wait itself is so frustrating for the farmer, and by the time he sows his next crop, again this time.
Right.
So if we are able to offset these losses, and there's so much potential for private sector. Today you have insurance for everything, but we don't have a crop insurance despite the size and scale of the issue. So that's a huge potential, and there's immense scope for private sector to actually come in and really benefit, help benefit farmers out of an insurance scheme. Low-cost community insurance. There are models. There are models at smaller scales. I'd like to quote here in Spiti Valley, where snow leopards prey on livestock. sometimes they come to take one sheep and 30 of them die due to panic. There's a very nice livestock insurance program that Nature Conservation Foundation has been doing for many years in these villages. It's a tri-party agreement between the Forest Department, NCF, and the farmers. And, you know, there's a corpus. Everyone pays a small premium, but the money is instant. Like someone sees, comes, assesses the extent of damage, how many livestock taken, and immediately, you know, money is dispersed. So when there are models that are working, will can always be scaled considering we have so much capacity within the country. So I think it's time, you know, we have such measures for crops. Crop insurance would really help in, you know, increasing tolerance of people towards wildlife, which is so important.
Very true. In fact, when we were having a conversation before we got into this podcast, right, and you mentioned about the human-elephant conflict in Coorg. And those in Coorg have been, generations after generations, been growing coffee, right? They've been dealing with this. Just that the animosity builds up and economically you're kind of hit, as well as, you know, nothing's being done about it. Could be even lives taken, right? So that's where, I guess, the animosity kind of stems from. And it's not so much that they don't want to live with the, because in the end of the day, we need to live and let live, right? With our habitat, you know, with the conflict happening at the fringes. And so being compensated will go a long way in just changing that equation also of how humans do think about, and even maybe the media also at some point, right? Because they see how the humans react, you know, societies react, and then based on which they
are. I think as a society, we are extremely tolerant. Even citing the example of Coorg itself, people are tolerant as a society, we are. But if it's affecting, you know, year on year, their livelihoods, that will slowly erode. And if no action is being taken to safeguard or incentivize people who are sharing spaces with animals and trying to make a living, that is going to exacerbate the problem. I completely agree with what you said, that it could, people generation after generation have been growing coffee in such high risk environments. And it's only fair that we respect the fact that they are leading daily lives in this such high risk environments, both with threat to lives and livelihoods.
All right. Thanks for sharing that. And I think the model that you mentioned where with the leopards, no leopards, and I think that's an interesting thing which can be replicated in other states also. So maybe we'll move to the farming implements, right? And so that we can just look at that and the fact that these are not tested through any BIC type of standardized agency, right, which certifies these. And this could be as simple as things like boots, certain types of gloves for snake bite proof and resistance. So can you talk a bit about that?
HSI has been working on mitigating conflict between people and snakes. We have collaborated with the Liana Trust, and we are trying to understand really what are the different aspects of human-snake bite conflict. In India, about roughly 60,000 people lose their lives due to snake bites. It's a very large number, right? I mean, it's not a small number. So one of the key things we realized is preventing snake bites, because in the event of a snake bite, there aren't many people who are going to hospitals. The trust in hospitals is very less. So we realized that we need to put most of our energy at least into preventing snake bites and, you know, distribution of gum boots to local communities, because most people who are getting bitten are farmers and bites happen in agriculture.
Yeah, and they're walking barefoot.
So it's been one of it's working well, but again, we need more such products, probably certified. Like you have ISI regulated helmets, for example, but we don't have safety tools for farmers who are so vulnerable to snake bites. I think, you know, if there are more avenues to improve safety of farmers who contribute to so much of our national income, but their safety is completely at stake most of the time, it helps a lot to have standardized things that can, tools and amenities that can help, you know, improve their safety. So this is one of the things that where a lot of work can be done. There is potential to improve safety and security to farmers.
So I think from the market perspective, I mean, there's lots that the market can do, right? Now that we're getting into it, we see that you're from your insurance, and then you have, you know, the equipments that can facilitate Now, I'd like to just touch upon how technology can help kind of compensate for the capacity constraints that a government has, or, you know, and you can even maybe touch upon how CSR could help.
Well, tech plays a huge role in various places. One of the things, of course, is using GIS to look at land use. If we have to conserve wildlife, particularly larger mammals, let's say like elephants or tigers, habitats are very important. And we unfortunately are losing a lot of prime habitats to non-forestry purposes or linear projects. But if we have the right, you know, land use maps, for example, strong GIS tools, that goes a long way in managing wildlife. Radio collars, for example, are now being used to monitor wildlife movement. There are examples of early warning systems like bulk SMSs and many other things being used to disseminate information about elephant locations, let's say. So technology can play a huge role in conflict management. And with so many tech companies in India and startups, we see immense potential. Crop guarding is a very, very stressful process. I mean, imagine the plight of farmers who have to work in the fields in the day and guard the same field in the night. So if there are, you know, technology that gives them, feeds them information of, hey, there are animals that are heading close to your fields, drones, night vision drones, slowly forest departments have started to use them for monitoring animal movement. But if there are tech companies are able to even locally train someone to just monitor, you know, fly a drone and see in a village where animals are, that goes a long way. Most of the time, farmers don't know if an elephant will come and raid their crops today or tomorrow or what time of the day. They have to be up all night, and they have to do it. If it's a crop like paddy, they have to do it for 5 months in a year, which is so much physical stress and mental anxiety.
Also, if the damage happens towards the end, closer to the harvest, right? It's a heartbreak.
It's so bad, very heartbreaking. And unfortunately, I've seen many such heartbreaking moments. And I could only wish if he had the information of where elephants are coming from, he could have probably tried to save the crop to the best possible extent. Technology could, you know, really help address some of these issues on ground.
Yeah, thanks for that, Vinod. So I think we'll just move on to the society, the samaj, right, and what can be done here. So either of you, Vinod or Shubhra, if you can just tell me, what are the ecological and socioeconomic impacts of the human-wildlife conflict on local communities and wildlife population in India?
I could touch upon the economics of it. Just giving Karnataka as an example, this is data from the Karnataka Forest Department. There were 40,000 cases of human-wildlife conflict reported in the year 2022-23, which includes crop damage, property damage, human injuries, human deaths. And Karnataka paid 34 crores in compensation or ex gratia in 1 year. And that's been the numbers, around 30 crores every year. This is the scale of conflict. I mean,
this is from the government. There's no private insurance at this point.
Nothing at all. 40,000 cases of conflict with animals is very high just for one state, right? So you can imagine what the scale of this is could be at a country level. And also, again, how our community is grappling with this. Today, it's come to a point where if you go to a farmer and if there is an elephant in his or her field, they will ask, hey, what is your elephant doing in my property?
Right.
So it's becoming more and more sort of exclusionary, as historically India has always, you know, societies have lived alongside it.
Right.
But that shift is a little, you know, sort of alarming many times when people are asking, what is your animal doing? By the constitution, the animal is, any wild animal is country's wealth, right? So how are we going to address this perception about wildlife, how people perceive animals, particularly people sharing spaces with these animals? How are we going to address their economic losses? If we don't safeguard lives and livelihoods of people and welfare of wildlife, which is habitats, we are only doing band-aid stuff. There has to be a long-term vision. of securing habitats, having strong laws. For example, if I loop in policy at this point, of how we can strengthen laws where we don't lose forest or non-forestry purposes. It's not just forest. I mean, green energy is another, you know, elephant in the room, where you have massive solar arcs coming up in grassland habitats, open natural ecosystems, which again is very prime habitat for a lot of animals.
It's detrimental. People think it's just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's termed as waste.
Exactly.
Right. So unless we are looking at it in a more sort of comprehensive way and not just addressing it in parts, we are not going to solve the larger issue. So there need be a lot of participation and involvement of communities in managing conflict. Most of the time, communities are left out. No one hears their voices. So unless we are bringing in, giving them that space and voice, and governments are working alongside with them, that's the potential way forward.
So Shubhram, would you like to just talk about promoting sustainable tourism, basically enabling policies that support and incubate such?
If you do look at ecotourism right now, there are several, there's sort of a monopoly of these huge resorts that come up near protected areas. They, you know, swivel their way into some really, really, you know, vulnerable parts of the forest, and they have resorts. And the biggest selling point of these developmental or any developmental project is, providing employment to the local people. It's usually that's the biggest selling point. However, not true. And definitely ecotourism is quite a, you know, ignored area. And what could be done, I think, is these resorts should be liable to help communities that live around them. And they should not just give out menial jobs. There's a larger impact that these resorts have. Once a resort does come up, it fragments the forest more. That leads to more interaction between wild animals and people who live there. So that, and, you know, there could be, again, livestock loss or human life loss. So if we could shift the onus on these resorts, that if you do, you know, fragment this forest, which is what essentially happens, and you know, they could, and they make such great revenue, they generate so much revenue, they could have a corpus out of which people living there, communities living alongside these resorts and wildlife, could compensate these people. And that is something that should be instilled into resorts. There's an impunity. I sense there's a lot of impunity that is given to resorts and ecotourism. Mm-hmm. Also, there's not involvement of communities. And there are several examples of, you know, successful community-led ecotourism, definitely in the Northeast. You can see so many ecotourism, which also, again, bringing back to what Vinod said about instilling a sense of ownership. So all the policies, even with Olive Ridley's or, you know, tigers, etc., there is a sense of, there's a very negative connotation attached to that animal. But again, if you look at these successful projects in the Northeast, where not only ecotourism is providing them with revenue, with the you know, they would want to share space with that animal if it's bringing in tourism, if it's bringing in money. And definitely, I think that there needs to be more involvement of community. And they know the forest like the back of their hand. Nobody knows the forest better than communities living within the forest.
You should always look for a win-win, right, in such situation. Social responsibility should be there. Often resorts are kind of on the outskirts, and now that's people are holidaying, they don't realize that beyond a certain time, the noise levels go quite high and it disturbs the habitat. I think even as society, us being mindful of the fact that we can have fun, but it shouldn't be at the cost of other living. So I guess we could go on and on, but unfortunately we're running out of time. So any key takeaways that you'd like to, just any closing comments, Vinod?
I'd like to end with, all I'm saying is there is hope for wildlife to recover. But yes, it does require a lot of, you know, collective actions and just people being mindful of, you know, currently I see that this, with some people, this complete disconnect of, you know, with nature and whatever, trees. You don't have to go to a forest, but living in a city like Bangalore, there are so many trees, but there seems to be a general, you know, sort of disconnect with nature. Even what we consume, a simple example would be, you know, we all drive on expressways. the Bangalore-Mysore Expressway now cuts through some of the prime leopard vulture habitat. But we are zooming at 100 kilometers an hour, enjoying the nice road, but we don't really think what cost did it have on, let's say, local wildlife people. Just being aware of these smaller things. Where do I get power from? Where is my water coming from? I still see people, you know, washing cars every day with so much water shortage. So I think in some sense we've taken things for granted, but it's important to be mindful that the water that we drink, Kaveri itself originates from Western Ghats, right? So if we're not aware of it, if you're not careful about where our water daily needs are coming from, it's all somewhere linked to forests and natural habitats. It's very important. As a society, we are aware and see the importance of conserving it. There's so much hope for wildlife to thrive in this country. And also, you know, a lot of people, companies or corporates coming together, not just seeing the nice, beautiful side of wildlife within the parks, but also doing their bit to see how they can leverage their own strengths and help people and wildlife to share spaces in a way that both parties are, you know, benefited. Mm-hmm. I think there is some involvement from, you know, the private sector, it could be in whatever capacity, technology or, you know, providing some infrastructure for government to manage it in a better way, that will definitely have a more lasting impact. And it won't leave conservation to just one agency or few NGOs. We are just a small, playing a very small part. And if societies don't come together, then we will not see any lasting impact. So I think that's where I'd like to leave it, with a sense of hope that there is immense potential for people and wildlife to share spaces in a way that it's respected, and communities and society plays a huge role, and not just one person or NGO.
Yeah, it's very true. But remember, you're playing a very important role. I think that's something that we should all remember as well, right? Each one of us plays a part that collectively we can make a difference. Yeah. So Shubhra, do you have any closing comments?
Yes, I do. I love bringing up the Indian Constitution, and I want to say that other than having fundamental rights, citizens of India also have fundamental duties. And especially Article 51AG of the Constitution says that it is a duty of every citizen to protect forests, lakes, rivers, water bodies, and wildlife. So it is upon us, if this is not something that is up to the government or to NGOs or international organizations, it is really up to us to, you know, value this, value wildlife. And I would want generations to come to see all the birds that I'm seeing today, because I am seeing a lot of birds disappear in Bangalore. I would come here and I would hear a lot of white-cheeked barbets going kutru, kutru. And now it's reducing. I really want the generations to come to have this experience. That's all I would like to say.
Now, on that positive note, I'd like to thank both of you, Shubhra and Vinod, for this lovely podcast. There's so much more that we can speak about, but I think we'll have another episode possibly to cover the other areas. Thank you very much. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Malti. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Malti. It was very fun.
Thank you. So with that, we'll be closing this episode. I just wanted to quickly announce that our both our PGP 48-week program as well as the GCPP 12-week program, the admissions are open currently. We have the early bird for the PGP that's closing on the 8th of April. So that's the upcoming deadline. The PGP starts on the 8th of June, and the GCPP next cohort starts on the 4th of May. Thank you.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.